Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Before we start this episode with Spitfire pilot Matt Jones, we have a bit of a hard sell to do, don't we, Jim? It's not like us.
No, because we don't do hard sells on our podcast at all. But we're going to do just a little hint of a hard sell on this one, and that is the great Cywell Airshow weekend on the 22nd and 23rd of June this year. And this is organised and run by a great friend of the show, Richard Grace. And there's no Flying Legends this year, people. You know, there's no mega Warbird Airshow apart from this one. Now, there are air shows at Duxford, but this is the daddy. And it's going to be absolutely amazing. And Richard and I are both doing commentary all weekend.
Great.
Richard and I are both doing commentary all this weekend. There is an amazing array of aircraft. I mean, really, from favourite of the show, the P-38, through to even a Spitfire Mark 1.
You don't like them?
Yeah, I love them too. Mustangs, more Spitfires. Yeah. I think the Tempest is going to be there. Various Messerschmitts, all sorts of stuff. It's going to be absolutely amazing. So I would urge people to go.
How do people find out about this?
There's a Facebook page, just put Cywell Airshow, or if you Google Cywell Airshow, it will come up as cywellaerodrome.co.uk/events.
Yep.
And you can find it and you can get your tickets.
And it's the Saturday and the Sunday that weekend.
And the Sunday, 22nd, 23rd of June. And it's going to be absolutely amazing. I mean,
those who don't know where Cywell is, I mean, because if we've got a listener in Northampton. So it's north of Northampton, isn't it?
It's in the middle. So there's no excuse for anyone.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay. So if you're from Aberdeen or from Truro, you have an even schlep. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. So that's the Cywell Air Show. And it was the website again, Jim?
Cywellaerodrome.co.uk.
Brilliant.
And that's Sywell Aerodrome.
So for any of you who want to come and see a Spitfire Mark 1 in majestic flight and hear Jim say nice things about it for a change, that is your big chance.
Yeah, just come along and come say hello and see some amazing aircraft.
Brilliant. Tally-ho, tally-ho. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. Jim, we have a very special guest on, and I may have given a slight clue as to the direction in which we're headed with that introduction.
Yeah, but I thought it was a good one. It was nice to kind of vary it a little bit.
Yeah.
Now we've got a very special guest, and our guest today is one of our Heritage Hero series. Matt doesn't quite think of it in probably the same way as me, but I feel very bonded to Matt, because in a way that's very deep and personal and special, because he took me up in a Spitfire for the first time ever.
Oh,
some years ago.
I remember my first time as well.
Oh, yeah. What was your first time?
My first time was at Duxford with John Romain.
Oh, that's strong. Yeah. Well, I had a very, very special experience with Matt. Beautiful date. It was up at Oxford, but back then, and we went up in the two seater, and I remember it's just one of these beautiful days. We were sort of formatting on a helicopter, little white fluffy clouds in the sky. I mean, it's exactly the kind of sort of cliche Battle of Britain sky that never actually really happened, because it was wet most of the summer in 1940. But in your mind's eye, it was just absolutely perfect. And I remember looking out over the wing and seeing the shadow on the ground sort of separating as we kind of lifted. Anyway, we had quite a long time up in the air. It was great. And I had control. Matt sort of gave me control. So I did my kind of, you know, 180 degree turn, not very well. And then last movement, the last thing we did was we hurtled back over the airfield, did a kind of low pass, rose up, did a victory roll, Oh, it was magic. But since then, Matt and I have become mates and we've done various things together. But you've gone from being the Boltby Flight Academy to now Spitfires. Do what it says on the tin. And it's the only place in the world, I think, isn't it, where you can train on a Spitfire?
That's right. We've got 3 2-seaters now and we train... We train private individuals who have got the chance of flying Spitfires either through buying their own aircraft or through someone giving them the chance, like someone gave me the chance. And we teach some militaries from around the world who are gradually kind of restoring their own aircraft when they've had history with the Spitfire over the years. So yeah, it's fun. It's exciting.
And we'll get onto this. So I'm just going to mention it briefly. But a few years ago, you went on this absolutely madcap adventure to fly a Spitfire around the world. It's the first time it's ever been done. I mean, it was absolutely insane idea. But I remember seeing you off at Goodwood and thinking, bye, Matt. This really could be the last time I ever see you. As it kind of sort of, you know, the sun glinted on the silver wing and you disappeared into the horizon. I remember feeling, oh, okay. But lo and behold, you did turn up again.
Yeah, a great mate of mine who was in the Air Force, who took me up in a typhoon once. Wasn't supposed to be able to make it and came and gave me one of those sort of friendship coins and said, I had to be here to wish you the best on Operation Certain Death. Which I thought was a fantastic way to get my to get me really pumped for something I was already very frightened about.
Yeah, you were quite nervous, weren't you?
Yeah. Although the day before we went, actually, you wanted to come to this later, but the day before we went, we were training an astronaut, a Canadian guy called Dave Williams, to fly the Spitfire. And I was sat in the office and he came in and said, how are you feeling, Matt, about your trip? And I said, to be honest with you, Dave, I'm pretty bloody nervous. And he said, let me tell you what it feels like to strap yourself to the top of a rocket. for half an hour, he explained what that felt like. And I left that conversation thinking, do you know what? I need to man up about this. That's a whole new level.
Amazing. So Matt, how have you ended up Mr. Spitfire, for want of a better way of putting it? You know, what's been your path to being someone who trains people how to fly Spitfires?
A huge chunk of luck. Right place, right time. I've certainly always had a huge passion for the aircraft. I remember as a kid walking past a model shop in where I grew up, and there was an aeroplane in there the same size as me, and it was a Spitfire. And I looked at it and thought, one day I'd love to fly that radio controlled model. What a result that would be. Not thinking that it might be possible to fly the actual thing one day. Became a pilot, having been an investment banker for 8 years, which really wasn't me at all. And I met a guy, Steve Brooks, whose aeroplane I was looking after at the time, and he bought a 2-seat Spitfire. And he said to me, I want you to learn to fly it. The rest of it, I don't remember. We had to recap the rest of that conversation because I was so stunned and thankful for the first part of it. But it was essentially, I want you to learn to fly it. I want you to inspire people with it, and I don't want it to cost me anything. And that was the start of the business.
Well, and he and I set up this. Right?
Still working on the third one. Yeah,
I imagine.
but you immediately you set that up initially, didn't you, up at Oxford, and then you moved down to Goodwood. How did the whole Goodwood move, West Hampnet, as it used to be called, in the Battle of Britain?
Yeah, so basically, what happened? I tried to get trained, and then realised it was really difficult to find anyone to train you, and that was the beginning of an idea. So we set the business up as a training school first. And as a result of the relationship we built with the CAA, they came to us and said, oh, you should apply to fly passengers in the back. And that was the holy grail at the time, but it wasn't possible. There was no regulation that allowed it because the aeroplane was a non-regulated ex-warplane. And we said that, we don't know how to do it. And they came back to us and said, well, you make up the application process and we'll consider it. So we got the first approval worldwide to take passengers up for, you know, essentially pleasure flights. How did we end up down in Goodwood? I'd never been to Goodwood before, and we were asked to go down there, which must have been in 2011, I think. And they had, and they had a gathering of Spitfires down there. And I remember turning up to this place thinking, I heard about the event, but never been. Heard it was pretty cool. Thought, what a great way to turn up to the revival, this amazing sort of vintage festival. And landed there, and I was Spitfire number 13, told to park right down at the end. This is not how I expected this experience to be. I thought there'd be red carpets and stuff, and I was the coolest guy there. But over the process of 3 days, walked around the place and thought, this is the place for us. This is just a fabulous environment, historical for so many ways, motorsport, but prior to that for its World War II history. And I think it's the last remaining, you'll probably correct me on this, I think it's the last remaining all grass Battle of Britain airfield on the South Coast.
Is on the South Coast, definitely, yeah.
And then I did my first ever display for James.
Oh, yeah.
At Chalk Valley.
Yes, you did, didn't you? I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in 20, yeah. That must have been 2012, I think.
Is that right? Yeah. I will never, ever forget that.
Really? Oh, that's good. Tom
Neal was on the ground.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, we are in many ways. Yeah. Tom Neal was on the ground and I was very excited, and I was very lucky in 2015 to fly with him in the two-seater.
Talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, okay. Well, I won't spoil that bit then, but I'd never met Tom, and I knew he was going to be there on the day. And I did my display, and I remember calling you and saying, what did Tom think? What did Tom think? And you saying, he never actually came out of the tent.
Oh, he was just brilliant. Now,
for the uninitiated, though, for someone who's stumbled into this conversation, Tom Neal is...
249 Squadron, Battle of Britain.
Veteran.
And Battle of Malta. First person to land a Spitfire in Normandy on D+1, I think. And he had a silver Spitfire at one point as well. At the end of the war, he was seconded to the Ninth Fighter Command, I think it was.
Is he still with us?
No, he's not, sadly. He was great. I used to ring him up, and every time I did, he'd go, James Holland, as I live and breathe. I'd met him, and then we went to the sunset dinner at Bentley Priory, which I guess must have been 2006, something like that. And they had the, you know, before the dinner, it was sort of big, black tie thing. Before the dinner, there was we all went out onto that kind of portico at the front, and the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight were doing their display and everything, and Tom had just had a hip replacement and was in a wheelchair, and he was stuck behind the column. I said, oh, Tom, do you want me to move you so you can see? And he goes, don't worry, I know what they look like. And actually, when we had him at Chalk, we got him at, you know, he was quite frail. You know, to get up onto the stage, he had to go up these steps, and he kind of staggered up, and he's really quiet beforehand. I thought, oh my God, you know, is he about to have a sort of seizure or something? He got onto stage, turned around, looked at the audience and said, I don't need the stick, it's just to beat off all the women. and then just sat down, and then he was just on fire. It was absolutely amazing. He was such a good lad.
Extraordinary. Well, you introduced me to him for the 2015 event, and I remember I went to pick him up in a helicopter and landed on the grass in front of the Duke of Richmond's house, and we were taken into the private side, and I was extremely reverential of being around him and making all the kind of pleasantries. And anyway, the Duke left, and we were left in this room for a while, and then we got up to, we were told that we were going to be taken down to the airfield, and we got up to follow this person who was going to take us down there. And I was stood behind Tom, and he said, sort of over his shoulder, he said, beautiful, beautiful room, this. I was like, yes, Tom, it's stunning, isn't it? Isn't it incredible, beautiful? Loads of stuff we could nick. And then his shoulders, I never actually saw him laugh, but I saw his shoulders from behind. So,
when it comes to you, when you're learning to fly a Spitfire, when you first sit at the controls of a Spitfire, what is there to learn? What's different to another aircraft? You know, because obviously it's an old plane, so someone used to the way a modern aircraft, you know, single propeller aircraft is laid out, the controls and all that would be different. And it's a fighter plane, so it's not like my brother-in-law's Cessna or whatever he's got that's designed to sort of fly straight and level one airstrip to another. What's the difference? What is there to learn?
Two main differences. One, the amount of power that the engine creates, and then the effect that has on the airframe. And two, the fact that the third wheel is at the back rather than at the front. So I think the best way of describing, and once they're in the air, they're like every other aeroplane. Just when I say like every other aeroplane, you can't really tell the difference in terms of those things. But they are, as Tom used to say, actually, talking about him again, very, very easy to fly. So I fly with people daily and who've never been in an aircraft before, and I'll give them control of the airplane within 5 minutes of being airborne. You know, it's that intuitive. And that gives you an idea of why these guys with 120 hours during the war could get in it and think, I have a chance in this thing. So the difference is the fact that you have the third wheel at the back of the aircraft. That makes it inherently unstable on the ground. The best analogy I think I can give is sort of holding a broom from the top of the handle and letting it fall, and it will find its neutral position in the center. Flying a tailwheel aeroplane is like turning it the other way around and trying to keep that broom, you know, stable. So the way you control that is with your feet, with the rudder. The thing that stops that being so easy is the amount of torque that the engine gives you in pulling the aircraft one way to the other. So you're basically just playing a balancing act with your feet to try and keep the aircraft straight. Now, we make a big deal of that these days, and I every time I find myself talking about how difficult it is to land a Spitfire, which it's not, it's just another skill you learn. I'm very much humbled by the fact that this was the least of the worries of the guys who flew them for real 80 years ago.
Yes, there's a good point. Yeah. And I suppose everything back then had a tailwheel anyway. So that it's the fact that now the aircraft don't, that it's unusual.
The reason they put the wheel at the back back then was because they needed massive engines to give great performance. And to get the most out of those engines, they needed massive propellers. The only way you should geometrically get a big propeller on the front of the aeroplane was to tip it back, and that gave you better ground clearance.
Great power is it's the other point that the first point you made about the aircraft. How does that, apart from the torque when you're on the ground, how does that manifest itself? I mean, if you in an aircraft, you don't put your foot down, so to speak, but when you put your foot down, what's that like?
Like nothing else I've ever done, I think. I mean, it's just, not only do you get this huge surge of acceleration, but you can feel the power of the engine the whole way through the aircraft. You feel it in your hands and your feet and your bum. You can hit, the noise is like nothing I've ever heard before. It's a much quoted phrase, but you become a part of the aircraft. Now, I'm not ex-Air Force. I'm a civilian. I've had the great luxury of flying military aircraft since. We've got a lot of military pilots who fly with us. They are all, if you cut them in half, it's Spitfire, because that's one of the greatest parts of the Air Force's history, of the Battle of Britain and that aircraft. And I've always thought emotionally that was the reason most of them wanted to fly it. Having had a go in a Typhoon, it's the most unbelievably sterile environment. You know, I've seen them at air shows, and you have this huge sort of crack of power, which is deafening when you're on the ground. In the aircraft, all you can hear is the air conditioning. You get no sense of speed. You get no sense of any of that kind of stuff. Whereas when you sit in this aeroplane, when you sit in the Spitfire, the whole thing is talking to you. The whole thing is telling you what's going on. You know, your head pokes out of this little bowl. So the visibility is fantastic. But your hands and your feet and your bum and your ears and your eyes, everything tells you how fast you're going and what's happening. Now, when you think about them in combat, that makes sense, because combat was fought at, 400 to 200 yards back then. So if you had to look in to see what your aeroplane was doing then, there's a good chance you're going to get shot down. Warfare these days is fought at 100 to 200 miles potentially, where it's all head down and you want an aeroplane that does most of the flying for you so that you can sort of tactically work out how this fight's going to happen. So it's an incredibly sort of visceral experience where this aeroplane becomes a part of you, and you sit in a Spitfire and there's dials everywhere, but there's only very, very small bits of information that you need while you're doing the kind of really key bit of flying them.
Which is flying along and looking for the other guy, basically, and rubbernecking and...
Exactly that. Jeffrey Wellham's book that is out there again because of work James did talks beautifully, about how important it was never to be looking inside. And he shot a couple of guys down once who were on their way back home. And he said from that moment, he never stopped looking over his shoulder every 30 seconds when he was flying.
Yeah. I remember that day we went up in Oxford. You know, you have the harness on and everything. And I remember thinking I could move forward literally just a couple of inches, just to the extreme limits of my vision, just see the tailplane. And the speed with which we lost the helicopter was amazing. And so suddenly that we've all read those bits where, you know, pilots say, I was in the middle of a melee, and then suddenly, you know, I went for a cloud and suddenly the sky was empty and all the rest of it. And you suddenly you could completely understand that.
Matt, how often do you open the throttles all the way and do more than 300 knots or whatever?
So we do more than 300 knots semi-regularly, but not by opening the throttle, normally by diving for aerobatic manoeuvres or for displays, etc. Once a year, we have to go up and do a full power test. And particularly, we've just put a new engine in the aeroplane, so I had to go and do a flight test, which was to full power in the air, and that's... That's exciting. They did it every day then, you know.
You made a peculiar noise then, Matt, if you don't know what I'm saying.
But Matt, so at the school, say let's forget the money for one moment. But say I want to learn how to fly a Spitfire. What would you need from me before you kind of took me onto your book?
10,000 more subscribers to this podcast.
yeah, we need that. But do you know what would I need? Sort of, you know, 1,000 hours of my logbook first or something like that, or is it not like that? What would you need to kind of go, okay, yeah, you can come and learn?
So we take everyone who comes to us who's interested in learning to fly based on their experience. Now, the amount of hours they've done is certainly a big part of that. But a guy who has flown 20,000 hours in an airliner is far less interesting to us than someone who's done 1,000 hours in a pit special or an extra, which is a general aviation aerobatic aeroplane with the third wheel at the back, i.e. tailwheel aeroplane. Age is a big deal. I think if you're past 60, it starts something we've noticed. I don't want to be ageist, but past 60, it starts getting harder for people to pick up the skills if they haven't been there for a long time. Certainly, all the legends that fly the aeroplanes that have been flying them 40 years plus now in the industry are hanging up their goggles at 70. You know, so at that point, they're thinking at 70, you know, despite all that experience, I now don't have enough time. So 60 to 70, you know, that becomes a bit of a problem. Prior to that, age is, you know, tends to be fine.
There's still time, Jim. But I suppose someone who's flown an airliner would be someone you'd want to like order Deliveroo for you. I mean, that's what flying a modern airline is
exactly.
Like,
isn't
it? You know,
exactly.
They have the heading.
It is
that row along the top of the cockpit. They have the heading, altitude, how fast they want to go, and then the computer decides on fuel consumption and engine wear and tear, and then you press go, and the plane does that. I mean, it's nothing like flying a single engine.
It is nothing. It is nothing like flying. It's like getting a marathon runner and expecting them to be a brilliant sprinter just because they're a great athlete.
Or be able to ride a bike. It's as different as that, isn't it, really? We're going to go to a very quick break. We've already talked about it going around the world. We'll see you in a moment, everybody.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. We're currently Angels 1-5 with
with Matt Jones.
Matt Jones.
Yeah, I want to go back to 2015 and that amazing madcap idea you had, which was to get as many Spitfires and Hurricanes in the air at any one time. And I think you had 36, didn't he? Something like that. And
35. Yeah,
yeah. It was absolutely amazing. And I came down and was doing that for a Channel 4 program at the same time with Dermot. And so we were live, kind of broadcasting on it. And I remember I brought my daughter Daisy down, and I remember her just lying on her back really close to the kind of edge of where they were taking off, because she had sort of privileged access, and just lying back and watching all these Spitfires and Hurricanes flying over. It was absolutely the most amazing day. And do you remember, it was raining in the morning, wasn't it? And it was miserable. We all thought, oh God, this is never going to work. And suddenly, you know, the clouds disappeared, the sun came out, beautiful afternoon. It was just amazing. How difficult was that to get that up and running? Because, I mean, you have these sort of mad ideas, don't you? And you suddenly think, I mean, do they just suddenly come to you while you're kind of lying in the bath or something? I mean, when do you suddenly think...
No. The pub is 100% to blame for all of these ideas.
Okay.
The problem is, when I'm sober, I tell people about the idea, and then the integrity kicks in and they have to follow through with it.
Well, you know, I have no integrity, so I never find myself in these situations.
but was it difficult getting that? Was that a sweat? Or did you find that everyone was actually quite up for it?
I mean, for the most part, everyone's up for it. You know, everyone who owns or has anything to do with these aircraft is 100% behind the history. Some people we had to sort of incentivize a bit, just because these airplanes are very expensive to run, which I totally understand. That was part of the plan. Some people just could afford easily to do it and did so. And we had one guy ship his aircraft from the west coast of the States to be a part of it. Quite incredible. So we got 35 from, gosh, I can't remember how many countries, because of the guy from the States, literally all over the world. So that was very special.
How many Spitfires flying are there in the world?
I think it's about 70. So we got 35 out of 70 flying Spitfires and Hurricanes at that time. I flew with Tom Neal that day, and I was with the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. So over the White Cliffs, we were, like you said earlier, James, it was a Battle of Britain sky. We were under, I'll never forget this moment. I remember we were under the shade, so under one of the clouds, and then burst into sunlight. And I looked up and saw Tom looking across at P7 and a Hurricane, the two of the sort of more, most historic Battle of Britain Memorial flight aircraft. And just, and we were over the White Cliffs at the Needles at that point, over the White Cliffs. And I've just gone cold now talking about it. I could not have been prouder being with him in that moment, nor could I understand possibly what it must have been like for him to have been there, and the kind of recollections that he must have been having in that moment. I stood up the night before. I had to, Prince Harry came down and he was part of it. And we had a dinner up at the house, and I stood up and said, congratulations on surviving the Battle of Britain, that you've got the most dangerous flight of your life still to come. And that's with me tomorrow morning. But fortunately, it all went well. To this day, the Battle of Britain Memorial flight guys who were flying don't believe I landed the aeroplane. They think Tom did, because it was the best landing I've ever done, I think. And they still think it was him on the controls.
Brilliant. I mean, I imagine that you stick a guy like that in the back of a Spitfire, and he knows what to do. You know, that Tom would have been able to fly it straight away, right?
100%, no problem whatsoever. In fact, and to segue, the Silver Spitfire for the round the world trip. So Tom had a Silver Spitfire, and thanks to James, I got to know him, and we became, in his words, friends. And that was a great honor. He was ill at the end of his life for a couple of years. And I kind of hoped, as a part of this project and part of the reason for this aeroplane being silver, was that he would sort of managed to stay alive long enough to see us off, but sadly that wasn't to be. So he was part of the inspiration, certainly, for this trip.
And it's a Silver Spitfire, because basically what you did was you stripped it of all paint, you know, polished up the aluminium, and for this round the world trip, you didn't want it to look military. You wanted it to be a sort of just a neutral representation of brilliant genius British wartime engineering or pre-war engineering, and to kind of sort of focus on the amazing engineering feat rather than what it did in the war. Is that right? Have I got that right? I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. The aircraft is so beautiful. It's easy to forget that it's a war machine and forget its purpose. We certainly didn't go around the world trying to hide its history. That wasn't the case at all. We just wanted to make it, you know, including ourselves, there are lots of people out there flying military coloured Spitfires around to remember all of those people who fought, gave their lives, etc., engineered them back in the day. This was more about the beauty of the design of the aircraft and being able to cross borders more easily, exactly as you said, James. And the final reason for it being sort of stripped like that. I saw a Spitfire being restored in Duxford probably 3 years prior to this trip. And there was a Spitfire wing in the wing jig, unpainted, but completely finished. And I just sat there and looked at the beauty of this, the work that had gone into creating this, you know, infamous elliptical wing. 3 weeks later, I came back and the same wing was in the same jig, but painted in its military colours. And whilst it looked right, it looked like a Spitfire wing, I remember feeling slightly disappointed. And I guess part of it was that I knew that this aircraft had history, but by covering it in 2017 paint, you couldn't really get close to the reality of the aircraft that was just a couple of millimeters behind it. And MJ-271, the Spitfire that we flew around the world, was very rare in that it had been essentially mummified in a museum. So it last flew in 1956 and then sat in this museum until essentially we bought it. So it was a very, very rare opportunity to actually restore an aircraft that was complete. The aircraft had 51 combat missions, one success. The idea of restoring it, doing 2.5 years' work, 40,000 man hours, and then covering it in paint and taking away and all those dents and dings and scratches and all those really, really important bits that are its history, just didn't feel right to me. So now when you see this aircraft from a distance, it looks immaculate and stunning and beautiful. When you get up close, you can see these sort of the marks of where, you know, engineers dropped hammers or pilots did wheels up landings and they had to make certain repairs to the airframe that weren't standard. It's all there and it's all real and you really sort of believe it's old and therefore you really believe it's history.
To go back to the actual round the world trip, and you know, obviously I was waving you farewell and everything from Goodwood, but I mean, how did it all go? I mean, it was a massive undertaking, wasn't it?
I remember when I first started flying the Spitfire, someone said to me, if you fly one of these things across the channel, 22 miles, you're an absolute idiot. Right. So 22 miles over water. There were 5 days on the round the world trip when I think we logged 1,800 nautical miles pretty much over nothing but water. I think that in itself gives you an idea of the scale of the stupidity of the man.
What was your route?
Yeah, so we flew north from Goodwood up through to Scotland, the Faroe Isles, Iceland, across Greenland, into Canada, then down into the US, back up into Alaska, and then from Alaska through the east coast of Russia, down into Japan. Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Vietnam, Thailand, India, Middle East, Europe, home.
Did you have an aircraft following you full of, you know, spare parts and waggle pumps and ailerons and bits of aluminium for patching and so on?
Exactly that. And there were three of us flying. So we had three pilots on the Spitfire, two pilots on the support aircraft, which was a Pilatus PC-12. And we rotated pilots through the Spitfire. And then when the other Pilatus pilot, Ian Smith, was flying the Spitfire, I flew that. So Ian Smith was the ex-officer commanding Battle of Britain Memorial flight. So loads and loads of Spitfire experience. Fantastic to have him with us. And Steve Brooks, my business partner then, and co-owner of the aircraft, was also flying with us. So the three of us shared that. And then we had our engineer with us, Jerry Jones, who looked after both aircraft, Ben Utley. So on the support aircraft, we had a slightly different door put into it so that we could open it in flight. And that way we could take lots of video footage and stills for the book and for the film that we had, the documentary we had made. And also to be able to throw out a survival kit if the Spitfire went in. So we had like maritime, polar, desert, jungle, different bags, kit.
Make sure you throw the right one.
To be honest, I think we just agreed that if that happens, throw them all out.
Yeah, we'll deal with that one later.
Put your jungle hat on the North Pole. I mean,
and did you have any kind of dodgy moments, Matt?
So I flew 44 of the 74 flights. 42 of them, I would say, I was the luckiest man in the world. I just thought, this is what a way to see the world, between 1,000 and 5,000 feet, looking down over the wing of a Spitfire at our beautiful planet. For two of them, I wished I was anywhere else. I was absolutely terrified on a couple of occasions, and both of them weather related. Both of them because we made bad decisions to go because we were behind schedule, trying to find gaps in the weather where there weren't, and primarily because there isn't anywhere near the kind of information that we are blessed with in this country when we're making decisions on whether to fly or not. The most frightening was for me in Russia, where there was just no one to talk to, no diver airfields for 500 miles away, no idea what the weather was doing, where we were going, and no idea what it was like, an hour after we'd left. I remember this one moment. So I found out that, my son was going to be born on this trip. And we were supposed to be on an hour and a half flight in Russia. We got stuck between two cloud layers. And these cloud layers were gradually coming together, which would meant we'd been sandwiched in cloud. Now, the Spitfire doesn't have any anti-icing capability. It was really bloody cold up there, which means flying in cloud, you get ice on the wings and the airplane falls out of the sky. So that wasn't really an option if something went wrong or we couldn't find where we were trying to get to. I remember looking out the window and seeing mountains poking through the clouds behind. So I thought, well, there's no forced landing opportunity. And if I have to jump out, I'm probably going to land on the top of a mountain, if not the side of it somewhere. So none of that was particularly interesting to me. We spent about 3 hours eventually trying to find our way through the weather to the airfield. And I remember seeing the Pilatus in front of us. Now, that airplane had all the sort of anti-weather kit it needed on board. So it was really just looking after me at that time and staying with me, which was great. I remember seeing that non-aerobatic airplane essentially do an aerobatic maneuver and dive and think, he's either lost control or he's found a hole and he's flying through it. And he had, in fact, found a hole through the clouds, and I followed him through, and we popped out 1,000 feet above the ground, and we were 25 miles away from Magadan at that point and able to see the runway. So that was the best beer I've ever had that night.
Yeah. That must have been absolutely terrifying. And you're just waiting, aren't you? You're just on edge the whole time.
You're just totally on edge. And so I remember, I mentioned Arthur being born. I remember sitting in the airplane at that, thinking, God, what are our options? We are close to having none left. I may never see my unborn son. But hey, it worked out.
It all worked out. Now, how long did it take, and how much of that time was someone with the cowling off going, oh dear, don't know what we're going to do about this? I mean, how much maintenance? Because they're old aircraft. They must be incredibly maintenance intensive, right?
Yeah, they are. So they need a lot of looking after. We are legally, we have to do a significant check every 25 hours. So we were burning through hours pretty quickly. That meant our engineer, Jerry, had to pre-approve a lot of different places that we were going to have this, for him to be able to do the maintenance when we arrived in each of them. That was a lot of work for him. it was very, I mean, I think it was the most frightening for him because, you know, as the pilots, once you're behind the controls, you have your life in your own hands. From the engineer's perspective, their responsibility is to give you an aircraft, both the Pilatus, easier, it was pretty much brand new, and the Spitfire, which was 80 years old, and give us an aircraft that is serviceable. And then they just sit there and hope that the work they've done is good enough to keep us safe. And I think that must have been terrifying for him, actually. And he did a fantastic job. And in many ways, the Spitfire was more reliable than the PC-12 was. A place in Russia we landed had a corrugated metal runway, which I've never come across before. And the Spitfire, although sort of, you know, it was sort of chattering, teeth chattering as we sort of rolled down it. The Pilatus couldn't work out what was going off, and it threw a load of it sort of on board computers out, and we spent a long time trying to reset them all on the ground, and then on the next flight still hadn't recovered completely, and the gear didn't go up properly. So the Spitfire did exceptionally well. We had a couple of gauge issues and one very slight rumble issue, which turned out just to be a slightly dirty plug. But otherwise, it was good as gold.
I remember being there for when you came back as well, but what I can't remember is how long the gap was. It was months, wasn't it? A couple of months?
4 months, yeah. We had two weeks off, so I went back to see Arthur being born, and everyone needed a break anyway at that time, so we left the aircraft in Japan for 2 weeks. The World Cup was on at the time, the rugby, which was great for some of the guys who stayed there, and then I came home. But coming home was very special. And you know, I've seen the White Cliffs a few times over the nose of a Spitfire or over the wing of a Spitfire, and it always means a lot. But never before have I been sat in one where I've had the kind of the feeling that the guys must have had every day after battle, where you're like, White Cliffs, it's home. That's home. And I sat there in the aeroplane, and I've cried around Spitfires quite a few times. It brings out so much emotion in so many people. That's the first time I've ever lost it in the aircraft itself. I was in bits. You know, there was home. We pretty much made it. There were the White Cliffs, and I was sat in a Spitfire and just thinking about everyone, you know, who fought all those years ago. It was an amazing moment. And then I heard the Red Arrows on frequency and had to man up and join them, and got to lead two of them back over Chichester, which was another schoolboy moment.
Yeah, it was an amazing day. It was an amazing day. I was very, very glad to see you off. Very glad, even gladder to see you back, I have to say, Matt. And have you got any more Madcap schemes lined up?
I do have one actually, but it's not one for public consumption at the moment. Okay. But I'll gladly tell you off record,
okay,
what it is, and maybe we can maybe we'll do another chat about it in a few years' time.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us. And I mean, you're going to fly the Spitfire until you're 70, right? That's my assumption. And it's 150 or whatever, however old the Spitfire. I mean, you know, there is something remarkable about these airframes that after all were designed not to be shot down, but to be used until they fell apart, at least, that they're still going after all this time. There's something amazing about that in itself, isn't there?
There is. And, these aren't, if we put them in museums, they will still play their part. But while they're flying, they're alive. And I think while they're flying, they're telling the story in a completely different way than an aircraft in a museum does. And, you know, children who see jets fly past tend to think they're horribly noisy and frightening. Children who see a Spitfire fly past or hear a Spitfire fly past who know nothing about their history are still incredibly moved by them for whatever reason. There is something exceptional about this aircraft and design, and notwithstanding its history, just the effect it has on people is amazing. I think if you built a Spitfire today without any of its history and gave it to a pilot, the guys would get down, get out of it and go, that is a piece of kit. That is an exceptional, exceptional airframe. And it's 80 years old. And look what it did for us all.
Well, thanks very
what
much.
What a note to end on. Yeah, that's just superb.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt. Silver Spitfire com if people want to look at the journey and see exactly how harebrained you are in a quantifiable amount.
And your Silver Spitfire book available in all good bookshops, presumably. Yeah.
Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you all again very soon. Thanks to Matt for joining us. Bye bye.
Cheerio.
Thank you guys. Thank you.